Hello and welcome to a brand spanking new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. Of course, you know me, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me as always are my associates, writer for the Film Stage, Danny King.
Hello, welcome.
And associate editor for the Film Stage, Nick Newman.
Well, hello.
Joining us this week, very special guest, we have Ethan Vestby from Fade to Black on CUTV.
Holla.
Holla. Bread?
I'm leaving.
Excellent. We haven't had a walkout on this show yet. Maybe we should strive for that. We should get someone here that we just really don't want and try to force them off. Anyone just joining us for the first time, this is how we operate. We will do a brief discussion topic related to movie news, and then we'll move into our feature discussion, which this week will be of Cosmopolis by David Cronenberg. I'm also going to give you my brief thoughts on Premium Rush, because that also came out this weekend. It wasn't screened for critics, and I thought you might like to know my opinion on it. So, before we get into that, though, I would like to remind everyone out there in listening land that you should check us out on iTunes, where you can subscribe to us so you never have to think about downloading us, and we'll just appear in your iTunes like a present. Also, you can rate us there and comment on the show, which is always appreciated, and you can always email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So, moving on into our discussion topic for this week, as everyone knows, or should know, a singular cinematic voice was lost this past week. Tony Scott, seminal director for the last 20, 30 years. Everyone should know who he is. Top Gun. I mean, that's his most ubiquitous film, I believe. It's the most enduring. We're not going to discuss anything about the circumstances surrounding his death. We wanted to spend a little bit of time kind of looking back on his work and seeing the imprint that he left upon the cinematic landscape. So let's start off with Danny. What did you think about Tony Scott's films, and what kind of impact do you see him as having on the film landscape?
When we figured out that we were going to talk about his movies, I decided I was going to try and rewatch as many as possible, because I kind of, when I went back and looked through all the movies he made, they were kind of movies that I saw in theaters and then didn't have much of a recollection of. And so going back and rewatching them, especially his later movies, I think it's kind of sad to think about how unique he was within the Hollywood studio system, because if you look at some of his later movies, they sound like tentpole blockbusters on paper, but when you actually watch them, they're very different. If you think about Deja Vu, you know, I can just picture seeing a trailer for that, and there's like a ship blowing up and Jim Caviezel talking about like religion and things, like he's like a villain that's going to sell tickets. And then you watch the movie and it's like about a guy who falls in love with a dead woman and then has to like save her through time travel. And it's like really deep and deceptively so. And I think you could say the same thing with The Taking of Pelham 123, and that the idea of a train being hijacked sounds like this really kind of high-octane premise, but if you watch it for most of the movie, the train's just sitting still. So it's kind of like Denzel Washington and John Travolta just talking to each other for like 90 minutes. And it's really fun, but it's fun in a way that's different from what's kind of the norm in Hollywood right now, which is like superhero movies and sequels and things like that. And even Man on Fire, which I think has some problems. It's a 2.5 hour movie. And the reason it's 2.5 hours is because it takes 50 minutes or so for them to build up this relationship between Denzel Washington and Dakota Fanning. So it's like you can criticize the movie for the length, but it's not like the length is drawing out the revenge part of the story as much as it's drawing out the emotional buildup. So I think those are just some of the things that, especially in his later movies, comparing them to where the Hollywood norm is right now, those are kind of things that separated his movies a bit and made them unique.
Ethan, what are your thoughts on this?
I was a huge fan of the guy, and he kind of belongs to the movement, or not movement, but the classification of vulgar auteurism, which is a new little saying on the internet, mostly applied to people kind of like Neville Dean Taylor or John Carpenter or John McTiernan, guys who kind of work within B-movies or big Hollywood movies, and sort of their craft is often overlooked just for sort of the content of the films. But when you really look at them, you see really how artfully they're made. And Tony, definitely, you look at his early films and it's just, there's definitely a look to them, and definitely Top Gun is one of the most influential Hollywood movies of all time in terms of at least the look of Hollywood films. Just the editing, the use of music, and there's all these other things that you can see in his early work, like just all these shots of usually light going through blinds and whatnot. It started with the fan, kind of. I don't know if anyone else here has seen that, but that is where kind of the batshit crazy Tony Scott started to come out. There's a sequence where, spoiler, someone kills someone, and it's set to Nine Inch Nails, a remix Nine Inch Nails song, and there's all these color filters, and that's really where the experimental Tony Scott started to emerge. And that definitely was in full force, starting with his BMW short film, Beat the Devil. And I recommend anyone, if you're interested, just go and see it. It's only 11 minutes. Just check it out. Really what emerged was this experimentation with form in terms of the duality of the image, often like cutting between two things, cutting between two various forms of media. I think that really was at its height in Unstoppable, which concerns often, you know, you're seeing the people on the ground, the working class dealing with this. You're seeing people in control rooms dealing with this. You're seeing the media cover this. So it'll be cutting between all these formats, like Chris Pine will be jumping on the train. It'll cut between people on TV watching it, how the TV's viewing it, how the people in the control room are viewing it. And you can definitely notice all of that throughout his work, especially taking in mind the surveillance themes, definitely seen in Enemy of the State. So I really think he was one of the most artful directors working in Hollywood. And even just I was watching just a scene from Man on Fire, the one, I think it's the scene where Dakota Fanning is abducted. And it's amazing how he's just experimenting so much in this one scene with color filters, with sound. It's like there's three times where it'll be like eye rolling. There's five times where it'll be like beautiful and thrilling. And maybe it wasn't perfect in that film, but I really admired just how he experimented.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people used to say, I mean, they probably still are, but they've probably toned it down now, obviously. There was this idea that he just went overblown in doing things like that. And I never felt that way. Like he wasn't going over the top just for the sake of doing something interesting. It always seemed like there was a method behind the seeming madness that he was employing, and I really appreciated that about him. Nick, what were your thoughts on Tony Scott and his films?
I think if you're going to discuss Tony Scott's career, you have to bear in mind that there are sort of, it's like what Ethan said, there are kind of two phases to it. There is the first half, which is a slightly more conventional, which is not to say that it's lesser, but it has a more conventional look and feel to it. You talk about something like The Last Boy Scout or Top Gun or Beverly Hills Cop 2, for instance. And then once you get to like The Fan or Enemy of the State, you see this visual style start to form. And it's interesting if you chart it from that point to the end of his career, how it keeps building up. And the way he's sort of stacking these motifs, these stylistic motifs and these reinforcements on top of one another over and over and over. And it didn't always work for me. I do think sometimes he would do a bit much, like in Man on Fire. I like that film, don't get me wrong, but sometimes I felt as though he was throwing kind of a lot at you when maybe it could have been toned down a bit. But then you look at something like Deja Vu, which I watched last night, and that's a great film. And I can't believe how great it is. Are we all in agreement there on it? Or
it's his best work, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I do. I think it's, I don't know about his best work, but it's definitely most ambitious.
It's up there.
But it's actually sort of, I feel a little funny saying this, it's almost a perfect film, because it's a complete, the subject matter fits his style so well. And it's also a very thrilling movie, which he is able to visually, he keeps you on your feet, the way he's cutting between things and the way he's emphasizing certain people in a frame, or how he's sort of delineating action. It's really incredible. And I feel a little funny saying that, because my favorite movie of his is True Romance, which might be seen as a bit more conventional than, especially if you hold it up against something like Domino, which is, you know, somebody, it is sort of like going inside the head of a drug addict for 100 minutes. But yeah, I have had my problems with him, but I do think when you look at his body of work, it is really kind of incredible he did this in the Hollywood system, particularly today. And I think that will be his legacy, ultimately, is how he carved out that spot.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about working within the Hollywood system, and he did make films that looked like nothing else that was out there. And you could definitely feel his stamp on it. But he was making, you know, like Danny said, these kind of on-paper conventional films, and that he was able to operate within that system and still inject this level of personality and creativity is pretty incredible. I really like Deja Vu. The funny thing is, I think my favorite film of his, it's probably a toss-up. I mean, there's a part of me that's going to always want to say Top Gun, because that's the first movie that I can remember seeing as a child, like just on cable or something, or my parents got a VHS tape and, you know, watching that film could have driven me into the military. Like, he had a way of making that life and those people seem so outrageous and awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to be there with these people. Like, he, from a character standpoint, he doesn't, it's almost hard to explain. Like, he makes blockbusters where you actually care about the characters, which is something that a lot of people feel like they can get away without doing. I mean, Man on Fire, like we said, it's a flawed film, but it's great because they do spend that time getting you invested in this relationship between this worn-out soldier and this little girl, and you can understand the depths to which he sinks in order to get her back and make her safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing that film for the first time. There was a feeling in the back of my head, like, why hasn't he blown anything up yet? Like, what's happening? But as the time went on and they continued to build this relationship, like, I enjoyed those scenes so much that the moment where she was taken just really gripped me and, like, threw me. And like I said, a lot of people wouldn't feel the need to really get into that. Like, they could go 15 minutes in and then just have the girl get taken. And it's like, well, you know, he's a badass. Of course he's going to get her back. But in this film, they really did ground it in that sense of personal interest. I will say, however, that I really loved Unstoppable. And I know a lot of...
Good, like, movie.
It is. It's a really good movie. I was kind of ironically saying how it was going to be my best of the year just because of the trailer, where you have Rosario Dawson saying it's a missile the size of a Chrysler building. But, like, when you get in there and you start watching it, like, it's enthralling. There's something about it that just takes you and it holds on. And just between the camera work and then again the great characters, I mean, if Denzel Washington ever finds another director who utilizes him as well, I think it'll be a small miracle.
Yeah, I was gonna say, one of, like, the best parts of, like, rewatching some of his later movies is how well he and Denzel kind of fit each other's sensibilities, because they're both kind of like no nonsense. They don't like to waste time, but there's this, like, swagger that kind of elevates the material and is really kind of engrossing.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I much prefer their working relationship to the one his brother has with a certain Australian.
That is, yeah, I think I could agree with that. In fact, yeah, I can agree with that. I just straight up agree with that. And,
but they didn't make a movie about wine.
No.
I bet Tony Scott could have made a fantastic movie about wine.
It would be like, the experience of watching it would be like being very drunk on wine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It would be about a bunch of people at a wine tasting that gets taken over by terrorists. And how do you stop them when you're completely blitzed?
And 99 Problems plays on the opening credits.
Oh, man. That would be so awesome.
Speaking of that, that's something I love about him, too. Just that how much hip-hop there is in his later films. Like, I just like the image of this, like, British guy in his mid-60s listening to Exhibit and being like, yeah, I'm going to put this in my movie.
That's right, yeah.
He made excellent use of that remix of the Requiem for a Dream theme, if you remember it. It's in the club scene from Man on Fire, and it's in the Hooters that Denzel Washington's daughters work at in Unstoppable. But yeah, I mean, it's funny you say that, because there were points when I was like, Tony Scott, like, listens to this and decides that this should go in his movie. Like, how awesome is that?
Yeah. What is our collective favorite film? Not collective, overall. What is our individual favorite film of his. Mine would be True Romance, which a lot of that has to do with Tarantino's screenplay, but Scott does do quite a strong job of directing that film.
Yeah, I really enjoy True Romance. And, you know, like you said, a lot of that does come from Tarantino's script. But I've seen good scripts get turned into shit movies. So,
But it also, but yeah, that's the thing. It says a lot when he takes Tarantino's voice and he makes it work without him behind the camera. You know, I mean, Robert Rodriguez really struggled with that in From Dusk Till Dawn, for example. And they're, and Tarantino's in that movie, too. So, you know, I feel like that says a lot about Scott's ability to adapt to material.
Well, he worked with a lot of great writers, Shane Black as well, Richard Kelly, Robert Town.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, just really quick, like, the kind of the line, you know, what we've been talking about is people call Scott, like, style over substance, but a lot of his movies, just at their core, are really well written. Like, if you look at Crimson Tide, which is kind of one of his more acclaimed movies, like, it's definitely technically proficient filmmaking, but what makes the movie really good is the writing and the arguments between Denzel and Gene Hackman. And I think, you know, you can say something similar about, like, something as late as Taking of Pelham 123, because I just really like the writing in that movie and what the characters are saying to each other. I think there's something unique about it that just really works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard for me to say what my favorite of his films is, because I mean, I don't think I actually own any of his films, which is weird to me. But then I realize that the reason I don't own them is because they're always on. They're like in heavy rotation everywhere. And usually I'd go with either what do I own or what do I watch the most. But with him, he's the type of director who, if I see any of his films on, I like immediately turn to the channel and I'm like, oh, I love this film. And I say that for literally everyone. And it's the type of film where, like, you're sitting there and you're halfway through it and someone who knows the movie will walk into the room and be like, oh shit, is this Crimson Tide or is this True Romance? It's like, oh man, this is unstoppable. And they just sit down and start watching with you. It's the type of movie that will, like, completely derail your entire day because you had plans and then you noticed that Man on Fire was on and you're like, yeah, I'll watch this. This is more important than going to the doctor. Like I said, from a biographical standpoint, I would go towards Top Gun. From a standpoint of, I guess, what I think is his greatest work, perhaps Man on Fire or possibly Unstoppable, because it's such like a throwback, awesome action film.
I also have to say, if you talk about his, it's amazing that The Hunger is his first feature, because that movie is so expertly crafted.
Yeah, I was going to mention that a bit. It's like, because you talked about how the first half is so, like, conventional, but that's the one exception, and it's his first movie, so that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's sort of, if nobody's ever seen The Hunger, the way I would describe it, it's almost as if Nicholas Roeg made a vampire movie after he watched Blade Runner all weekend. That's the best way I can describe it. And it's got David Bowie as a vampire, and he is amazing in that film.
And it introduced me to one of my favorite bands of all time, Bauhaus, that are in the incredible opening sequence.
Yeah, that's a great sequence.
That opening sequence is, I watched that in a dark room at like 1:30 in the morning. That was terrifying. That is a great scene. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess that draws our discussion of Tony Scott to a close. Does anyone have any final thoughts they'd like to place out there?
I'd just say probably Deja Vu for my favorite. I don't think I gave an answer yet.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I haven't seen Deja Vu enough. It's an interesting thing to say about a film that I've seen like 3 times, but I feel like I haven't seen it enough.
It on Blu-ray if you want to come over.
Hell yeah. I have no idea where you are, but I'll be there in anywhere from 1 to 24 hours. Moving on into our review section, before we hit Cosmopolis, I just wanted to say Premium Rush, I went out and saw it on my own, and it was awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Really? I swear, guys, I'm not trying to mess with you. I'm not trying to make you go see a terrible film. I wouldn't do that to you. This is it's like a throwback film. It's hard to explain the appeal of it. It's just such a simple, straightforward, like, fun, lighthearted, but engaging chase film.
How many CGI POV bike shots are there?
Actually, this is the thing. I obviously wasn't like looking at this with a fine-tooth comb. But there weren't many. Like, there are points where they...
Because I was hoping you were going to say there was a lot.
I think we want an exact number here, Brian. So
I'm
going
to say maybe four.
Check your notes.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a... Like, the thing is, there's not a lot of that in this film. And by that, I mean, much of this is just straightforward. Like, you can tell that real people are really riding... And it doesn't, you know, go insane. It's not like a step-up film for, like, bicyclists. Like, there's a point where they do a little of the trick bike stuff, but it's not overblown. It's not over the top. Like, this is the type of thing. And it's completely ridiculous. Like, these things don't stand up to any kind of story scrutiny, but in the moment, they're so fun that you kind of just give it a pass. It's hard to explain the appeal of this film. It's just... the type of film you don't see much anymore. It's not bombastic. It doesn't do ridiculous things in order to, like, keep your attention. The one concession to kind of amped up, you know, newfangled filmmaking is every once in a while they'll slow down time and it will show Joseph Gordon-Levitt's thought process for how he's going to navigate through traffic. And so it'll do kind of like a GPS arrow that would show where he would go, and then it would show him, like, riding along that and what would happen if he did. Which is kind of hilarious. And they don't do it so often that it gets bludgeoning and demeaning. Like, the three or four times that they do it, it's interesting and it makes sense. And it's been a while since you saw it the last time, so you're like, yeah, I'm ready for this again. It's just a film that has a really good sense of tone and pacing. Like I said, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a really charismatic, interesting person to watch. He gives a lot, or he does a lot to ameliorate the kind of ridiculousness of this whole premise. And Michael Shannon... I could watch that guy eat soup. So
he eats soup?
Yeah, I could see that too.
Yeah. He doesn't eat soup in this movie. That's unfortunate. No, it's really good. So if you're on the fence about it, if you've got an hour and a half, I would say go see Premium Rush. It's a fun little movie.
Cool.
Yeah. And no one else has seen it, so no one can tell me I'm wrong. This is great.
I plan to see it. I'll probably agree with you because it's been getting good reviews. So
yeah, that's the funny thing. Like, it's been getting good reviews. I'm surprised that they didn't release it to critics. I know it's not the type of movie that would have maybe really been bumped by that, but
it screened in New York City.
Oh, did it?
I was sent an invite, but I didn't take it.
Oh man, ouch. Premium Rush, ouch. Good time. No, it's good. Check it out. You won't be disappointed. And if you are, email me at podcast@thefilmstage.com and tell me why I am wrong. But moving on from that, we can talk about Cosmopolis, which is what? A film out in limited release that is directed by David Cronenberg and starring Robert Pattinson.
Where is your office? What do you do exactly? You know things. I think this is what you do. I think you acquire information and turn it into something awful.
What does it mean to spend money? A dollar? Million?
Don't trust standard models. Think outside the lines.
You need to be inflamed, don't you? This is your element.
This is a protest against the future. They want to hold off the future.
That's a scandal, man.
Dying's a scandal, but we all do it.
So, Cosmopolis. Really, giving the synopsis for this film doesn't do it justice. Basically, it's about a 28-year-old billionaire who decides he needs a haircut. And they drive to the haircutting place. But it's a lot more than that. It's an examination of many thoughts and ideas. It's based off of a pretty fantastic book by Don DeLeo. And I'm not going to be the one to start talking about this. Nick, you wrote the review for this on the film stage. So why don't you kick us off here with your thoughts on Cosmopolis?
I love it. I think it is an incredible, visceral film that is... at once a thrill ride, an intellectual thrill ride rather, and is also a really pointed, critical, and brutal examination of today and the modern world. I think this is a movie that's very much about today and how it doesn't take place in the real world. That's something that people need to understand with this movie, is that everything in it is sort of fake. The limo that the character rides around in, the rear projection that you get of New York City, which looks deliberately cheesy, the TV that he watches, the restaurants that he goes into, the bookstore, everything about it is sort of facile and doesn't feel real enough. It's about like 3 degrees off from our real world, But the idea that I think Cronenberg is getting at here is that it's close enough where you can look at it and sort of shudder. To me, that's scarier than anything else he's ever made, is how much it reminds me of the real world. I saw this movie in Midtown Manhattan, and I got out and I walked around, and I was just thinking to myself, Jesus Christ. It's like I walked out into the movie in a weird way.
Well, it'd be fair if you were walking out to Toronto, it would be more like you were walking into the movie.
That's true. Fair enough. But it is... It's something that I think you can watch and get a good thrill out of, but it really does work the brain. I think it's an incredibly stimulating movie. Not only that, but there's this – we can get into this more, but there's this weird belief that Cronenberg's later movies haven't been quote-unquote cinematic. That's bullshit, right? Are we in agreement there? That is complete crap that
what do you
people
mean
are
by,
saying.
What do you mean by later movies?
Dangerous Method and Cosmopolis, specifically.
I would agree with that.
Yes.
No, I would agree that they're not cinematic.
Really?
Yeah, I hated Dangerous Method.
Well, we're going to have a discussion.
Yes, we are.
Do you like that movie, Nick?
Yeah, I do.
I was just wondering.
Okay. This movie is incredibly cinematic, and I think it's more entertaining than just about any other film that's come out this summer. Believe it or not, and almost the entire picture is folks talking about stuff that's sort of meaningless. I love it.
Okay, well, I think you're drunk, but let's move on to Ethan. What did you think of Cosmopolis?
I love the film as well. In fact, it's still the best film I've seen so far this year, though I'll preface this by saying I actually saw the film over 2 months ago, so slight details might be a little hazy when I'm talking about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's Canada. We got it 2 months early. But anyway, I agree. I found this film extremely chilling. Just as Nick mentioned, how much artificiality there is in it. And it's really what got to me. And I think a lot of people haven't liked the movie. Sort of they talk about the dialogue. They say it's so long-winded. It's so obviously dense. It's hard to get into. There's no one to like. But the thing I think about the dialogue is that I think it's not text as much as it is texture, in a way that think about how these characters are rich, and in a way their words are their possessions. In a way, these conversations in a way are sort of overwhelmingly false. And when you think about it, when the things that are supposed to be intellectual, that are supposed to be grand, they're false sort of complexities. When they become banalities, when that's banalities in a way, they become evils. And that's part of why I found the film so chilling. And I think, too, this film definitely fits within an auteurist context. You can definitely look at the limo and the use of technology as an extension of Packer's body and whatnot. So just some of the acting in this movie, like, just this has one of the best, this has maybe the best cast in any movie I've seen this year. Including casting one of the best actors in the world just to throw a pie in Robert Pattinson's face. But yeah, I completely love this film. What about you?
All right. Danny, what did you think about Cosmopolis?
I really admire Cosmopolis. I'm having trouble figuring out exactly how much I like it because to me, Dangerous Method was an easy movie for me not to like because I just thought it was a boring screenplay. So I could come out of it saying, you know, David Cronenberg is still a first-rate filmmaker. These are still really good actors. I just think it's boring writing. But this movie, it's clear that he has a vision and every decision he makes is so conscious and clear in his head that you know this whole thing is meant to be, but it just left me very cold. And it didn't resonate that much. And the problem with that is part of it's by design, because I think one of the themes of the movie is that it depicts all of these really ghastly incidents. I mean, you have these people running through the city with rats. You have a guy setting himself on fire. But yet it's all depicted at this like eerie distance. And I think that's, you know, it's meant to be said. Like what Nick said, it's kind of a parable about modern life and about these rich people. But at the same time, it's one thing to say that's the point of the movie, so it's okay. But on the other side, like, I didn't really feel anything while watching it. So it's hard for me to be completely satisfied with it. I think part of the problem is that it's such a play-by-play adaptation of the novel. I think that if I hadn't read the novel before, I would have gotten completely lost in the conversations and not known what they were saying. You know, you can debate, like Ethan did, as to how important that is, but I think there is something to be said for the fact that watching these people say what they're saying is just so weird that you can question how much resonance it has. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm very kind of having a schizophrenic reaction to the movie because I admire it a lot, but it didn't really leave me with much of an impact.
Did you not get kind of an emotional attachment, though, from Paul Giamatti? I found I did.
Paul Giamatti, that's an interesting scene. I think it was probably the best scene in the movie, his scene. But on a basic level, I think the Pattinson character doesn't come across as kind of nihilistic as he's intended to. So some of the stuff he does throughout the movie feels a little bit like he's doing it on cue rather than this has been building up in him throughout the movie. So that was kind of one of my problems with it. But I like Paul Giamatti. I think he does a really good job in his scene.
So I guess it's my turn now, which is something I've been dreading. Not a fan of this film. Not a fan at all. I read the novel, which is perhaps my greatest mistake, because this is a very, very pat, very simple, very basic adaptation of the novel, to the point that it's as though you got a couple of friends to just read the dialogue of the novel to one another. And that's a problem for me. I couldn't detach myself from the fact that I was seeing an inferior carbon copy of a much greater work. And that honestly probably sunk the movie for me. There was no coming back from that. The acting was uniformly good, very arch, which I guess is okay in certain situations. But like Danny, I had trouble really connecting with Pattinson's nihilism. I just, in the novel, it's so clear and you see the uptick. And in this film, there's no emotional consistency in him. And I feel like a big part of that is just the way that the movie moves and operates. There's just like, I think one of the things is in novel form, you can take a break, you can step away. And not only that, but you can get a better view of the interior world of these characters. And this isn't a novel that really does that much. Like the novel, basically from my memory of it, is almost 95% dialogue. And I'm sure that that's not an accurate representation at all. And I like the dialogue. Even though I poked fun at it in our opening, I enjoy it in the novel. I appreciate this weird, everyone's talking about we want a haircut. And I like the idea of them saying just what at the end of every sentence. Everything's a question. Everything's being probed. The concept is great. The execution on a film level, I don't want to say that I hated this movie, but I will never see this again. And I have told people who were interested in it not to go see it. I can't get behind this film at all on any level. And it hurts me to say that because I like Cronenberg. And I think that it's an interesting choice for Pattinson and that individually his scenes are very strong, but they don't cohere into a narrative that I give a shit about. Which is odd because I'm already invested because I read the book. And I don't know. Like, there was a point walking out of the theater where I said to myself, if this is a comedy, then it's pretty good.
I think it is very funny.
Okay, because I couldn't... It was like a parody of a movie like this. And it was...
What is a movie like this?
Just like the heavy-handed conversations and the... like allusions to our world that aren't really in our world, and these people with their highfalutin philosophizing all the time. Like,
right.
This is a much better filmmaker making fun of people who would try to make this movie. Like, if this movie is a parody of the idea of what the movie of Cosmopolis could be, it's a valiant effort. I still don't like it, but at least I can get behind it more than I do currently.
So it's a parody of movies like Hit and Run?
Did anyone see Hit and Run?
No.
We could have given a second to that.
No, but I was on a trip recently, and I watched Adult Swim every night just to fall asleep to, and every single commercial break they played an ad for Hit and Run.
We were talking last week about how I would see those ads, and I couldn't sync up in my head that it was a real movie, because the ads did have that like tinge of like, this is fake, this isn't real, we're making fun of movies like this.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, I don't know if it is or not. It could be a very good movie. I'm not going to judge sight unseen. I can, however, judge Cosmopolis, which I did see, and my judgment, not good. Not good at all. Yeah, I've never been in a movie where, you know how like in a horror movie or a thriller, like there'll be an audible sense of relief when the credits start and people are like, wow, that was like, I was put through the ringer and it's over now. And you just have this like feeling of release because it's over and you've gotten through it in a good way. Like a roller coaster. Like at the end of a roller coaster, everyone's like, whew, damn, that was awesome. This was like that, only if it was completely terrible. Like my entire theater audibly thanked the Lord that the movie was over. And I'm not going to say Jesus. I was right there with them, but I could definitely understand where they were coming from. I especially felt bad for the two gentlemen behind me who were talking about their favorite Cronenberg movies and constantly name-checked History of Violence, The Fly, Videodrome, and Eastern Promises. Because knowing the novel, I knew that they were going to be sorely disappointed, and I imagine they were. And I like to think that it ruined their weekend. But yeah, those are my thoughts. feel free to beat me up about them.
Well, see, I've read the book as well, and I think there were a lot of things where he translated to film in a brilliant way. Like, for example, throughout the novel, there's the funeral of the rapper played by a Canadian, as in the film, played by Canadian rap star Kanon. But in the, you know, throughout the novel, there's these updates on what it's like, his funeral march going through Times Square. And in this film, it's really condensed to one thing that I thought was truly brilliant, which is just Packer alone in his limo listening to him on an iPod, which again brilliantly shows this kind of this theme of alienation and technology. So that was just one example where I thought he brilliantly translated something. But
And I also, we have to get more into the conversation scenes of this film, because I take umbrage with your interpretation of it. But in terms of portraying this, I think even that is quote unquote cinematic, the way he is framing the people and how they sort of bounce off of one another from shot to shot, or in the very few instances where people are on the same page as him, they kind of, he'll put both of them in the center of the screen and they kind of bleed into each other. I think that is such a brilliant move on his part. And it sort of, maybe the thing about the dialogue, okay, now maybe we should jump into it, is that none of it particularly matters. But that's the idea, because all these people are, the only thing these people are discussing is how to get something, how to acquire something that they feel is important. And they're trying to get it from Packer because he is, of course, the rich, powerful person who can get it for them. And that speaks very much to the idea of what a terrible world this is. And the way he's, Cronenberg is visually displaying it is he's having them, they're on one side. So a character will be on the left side of the screen in one cut, and then the next are on the right. And that, to me, is the best way you could possibly show this discord between them. But even then, I think the dialogue is, if it is bewildering, but I think it's engaging because it's so bewildering, and it keeps you on your feet, and you're trying to work your way through it.
I think one of my problems with that is that it stays that way throughout the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, there's not really a lot of progression there. Like Ethan, with the moment you mentioned in the limo about how he's isolated, to me, that's an idea that is there from the first frame. So it's not like there's progression. And I think that the conversations throughout the whole movie, you know, while some of the lines may stick, they're very staticky. And I don't think they go anywhere. So part of my problem with the overall trajectory is that I don't know that the philosophy of the movie finds some place at the end that isn't already in the shot of him in a limo that looks like a spaceship getting his prostate examined, you know, and whatnot. So I don't know that it really builds to anything on an intellectual level. So that's one of my issues with it. I don't know if you guys have anything that you thought maybe I missed or...
Well, I mean, definitely his character. I think the film definitely, when his character gets out of the limo towards the end, like I think the barber scene is probably the best scene in the film, or the scene with Kevin Durant near the end, and where Packer becomes a little more active of a character is definitely. And it's a scene too where it's in the trailer, so it's not a spoiler, where he shoots himself in the hand. It's definitely, you're seeing that his character is, there is a little bit of evolution there to me of him trying to feel something and then this character changing. At least I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
I get that on an intellectual level. My problem is that I never felt it. Like, static was used. Staticky was the term. It's true. There's no change. I don't get a feeling that he began in one place and ended in another. It really is like for the last 5 minutes, they just like flipped a switch. And it's like, oh, right, he's supposed to be crazy now.
Well, what do you guys think of Robert Pattinson's performance in this film? Did he sell you on this character or not?
Well, like I said, scene to scene, he was very good. Like, if this were an actor's reel, I would totally cast him in a film with like a complete character with an arc. But he didn't. And I don't know if it's his fault or the script's fault or the direction. Nothing was building on itself. There was no culmination of thoughts and ideas to me that really made me know what he was doing. And I read the book. I should be able to fill in these gaps on my own. But there's just nothing there. It wasn't like he was taking steps upwards on this ladder to nihilism. It was just, he's saying the words and he's saying them well, and you know, his facial expressions and his physicality were fine, and he sat there and convincingly got a haircut, like the best haircut in all of moviedom. But yeah, I don't know. I couldn't get it. I wasn't in there with him.
See, to me, I feel like the third act turn, I think the two keywords there are Nancy Babich would be. To me, that felt as though it was him doing this because he knew he could, because he knew there wouldn't really be consequences, that he could just make something up and say, oh, well, this happened because whatever. I'm trying to be vague here because we're not necessarily in spoiler territory. But I think that that's sort of the idea, is that maybe he's not building to something because maybe he's already there. Maybe that is just him finally saying, fuck it, I'm gonna go out and I'm gonna act on my own. Because a lot of the movie he's doing almost everything inside a limo, where it's this contained world and he's got his security guard outside and he doesn't really have to worry about those sorts of things. But then when he goes out into the real world, he has to decide, am I going to keep acting this way or am I going to inhibit myself? And he decides to basically keep acting that way. And I think that reinforces the theme of the movie, which is that the rich are evil, soulless, et cetera, people. And this is basically what you're going to get. This, what they're doing in their business is equivalent to what he's doing outside by that point in the film.
I do think Pattinson is actually strong at this, because just, I think he's a limited actor, but I think he's very well, he's perfectly cast, because he has that complete, not to evoke Twilight here, but that sort of vampire look to him of someone who's, you know, good looking, thin, pale, kind of got an angular face and looks like they're up to something kind of evil in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really works for this character. And again, I think he's somewhat of a limited actor, but he's very well directed and he suits the character. And I think he sells to me that aimlessness, that sort of that shell of a person very well. And people say maybe that's just something that comes with him being a bland actor. But no, I think it is something that he was able to communicate.
Couple things. Nick talked about the Nancy Babbitt scene, and I think that's one of the best scenes in the movie, as well as the Giamatti scene. I think one of the reason is just the simple fact that they're out of the limo. And so it gives, I mean, like the Nancy Babbitt scene is almost a conversation in just one shot. It's deceptively cinematic in the sense that after all these scenes in this suffocating limo, you're getting people that can interact in real space, and tension can build from the beginning of the scene to the end, because the Nancy Babbitt scene is one of the few where you end the scene at a different, well, at least you feel like you end the scene at a different place than where it began. So to me, that's one of the things that I like about maybe the last third of the movie. In terms of the performances, I actually don't think this is much of an actor's movie, because it's so consciously faithful to the book's dialogue, which is inherently kind of cryptic, and the characters are directed in a way to be ciphers. So I'm not really sure that, I mean, I don't think they're bad performances. I just don't think that they're really, they're more like part of the vision of the movie than individual characters to me and individual performances.
Yeah, I would disagree, though, because I think the actors do stand out on their own. I can think of, well, this is the Juliette Binoche scene. This is Sarah Gadon's two or three sequences. Then you have Samantha Morton.
And Kevin Durand, I think, is excellent in the film, who plays his bodyguard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they do stand out on their own. And in my memory of the film, it doesn't blend together. It's very specific and sharp in that sense. For instance, I think Sarah Gadon's performance in this movie, she plays his wife, and there's a very funny element to this where you don't realize that it's his wife until the second or third time they meet, and they just casually mention it. And I think she's incredible. I don't know what you guys made of her work.
She was good.
I was a big fan of her from when I saw her on the Canadian drama Being Erica. But yeah, she's great in this film.
Yeah, I just think she acts perfectly as the movie's femme fatale, basically. The way she speaks and the way she moves her body is very mysterious and sort of seductive.
Yeah. The entire time I was watching her, I was like, I can't wait till she does a film noir. Like, she'd be in that. And it'd be a much better movie than this one.
Wow.
Sorry, that's a cheap shot. I haven't said anything in a while, and I feel like I need to remind people of my
opinion. Oh, we could talk about the music and the score, which is really cool. I think. Maybe not.
One of the reasons I was laughing throughout the entire last scene of the film is because of the music they were playing. It didn't seem real. Like, this was not it's like I had a nightmare about a movie, and this is what it was. That's cruel.
But maybe that's a good thing.
Is it?
Yeah.
It could be. I was like, I cannot believe that this is what's happening right now, and this is what I'm watching. And not in, an awesome way. Like, this is, challenging and incredible, or, this is a great subversion of the text. Like, just poor choices. Badly executed.
In what sense, though?
We'd have to get into spoilers. I don't want to.
We could go into spoilers.
I was about to say, are we cool with going into spoilers?
Yeah.
This could be a good lead into spoilers. So yeah, I think let's just break it down to the purest possible question of the film's quality. Would you tell people to see this?
Yes.
Depends on who I'm talking to.
Yeah. I think it's a movie I look forward to seeing again and thinking more about. But if I were to recommend it to someone, I wouldn't be surprised if they were unsatisfied with it.
Yes. Well, I'm going to say that this is a movie I wish I hadn't seen, so its limitless potential could live on in my mind rather than the letdown of reality. Man, I really sound like I hated this. Okay, so my problem... spoilers, by the way, everyone, if you didn't pick up on that. Spoilers, my problem with the final scene. The framing of the shot. He's in the foreground, Robert Pattinson playing Eric Backer. I mean, he's in the foreground. You know, he just shot himself in the hand, so he's holding it up, and Giamatti's behind him with his ridiculous gun. I understand that the gun is supposed to be ridiculous, so I'm not saying that to be like, this movie sucks because the gun is weird. Like, I get it, that's a part of his character. And
Cronenberg loves weird guns.
It wasn't as cool as the one made out of chicken bones and an artificial bridge in someone's mouth, but Existenz for the win. I missed that movie. I need to see that again. But no, I mean, just like their conversation, and then just the fact that he's holding the gun to his head and the music is like building up, and it's just like this really like shitty 70s style like climactic music, and then it just cuts to black, and I was like, like I said, it didn't seem real. Like, it seemed like the type of... It seemed like a first film. This seemed like, I have some people saying some interesting shit. I'm going to get a couple of great actors. I'm going to make them say these words, and it's going to be really cool. And then I'm going to, come to this epic finale, and I'm going to have, this ominous score playing, and then I'm going to cut to black, and people's minds are going to be blown. And I just couldn't get behind it. It was bad.
I don't think it's meant to blow your mind, though.
But I'm saying that's how it came about. That's how it felt. And I understand that it's not, but it's just, I don't know. It didn't work for me, on any level.
Mm.
And it wasn't, even like this sense of surreality. It wasn't like a Lynchian type of thing where I can understand where the oddness is coming from. The oddness at times didn't feel like it was purposefully executed. It just felt like this is a poorly made film.
But I mean, if, say, the shot had held on a little longer and if the final shot of the film was actually him getting shot in the head, would you find it more satisfying?
I don't think so. Unlike many people, I have no strong opinions about Robert Pattinson. I don't feel like I need a GIF playing on my computer of him getting shot in the head. I don't know, like,
because I find that the final shot of the film, the look on his face, to me, it sells it. It's like, in a way, this film is about it's the end of his life, and it's about the end in general.
And I get that. I don't want people to think that I don't like this film because, like, I didn't get it. It's a very narcissistic thing to say. I got it. Like, I understand, and I know what choices were made for what reason. And like I said, scene to scene, Pattinson is very good. There's just something about that final scene. Like, the look on his face is kind of devastating, but it wasn't earned for me. It was out of nowhere. And the way that, like I said, just the way it was constructed, just it stopped me dead in my tracks. And I was like, this is happening. It's almost over. Sweet. I don't know. Like, I just couldn't. I couldn't do it, man. I wasn't there. I wasn't in it.
Maybe we took the shot differently. Is that possible?
Possibly. Explain.
I don't know. I guess I read the last scene as him just finally accepting what Paul Giamatti is saying, and the look on his face, I think, is one of shame. Honestly, I think he feels shame because he realizes everything that Giamatti has said to him is in fact correct, and he can't live with himself anymore, and that's why he needs him to shoot him in the head. And so I found it very powerful in that sense, and almost tragic even. So
to me, it's like, I think one of the reasons that I wasn't satisfied with it is because mostly what we've been talking about for the past 10 or 15 minutes is like the characters, but the way the film presents itself, it seems like it's supposed to be more about ideas than characters. And I don't know how layered it is on an ideas standpoint. Because, like, you can talk about if his character development really moved you in the last scene, but I don't know really where the movie is going on an ideological level other than capitalism is destroying the world and greed is destroying the world.
A specter is haunting the world?
Certainly, a rat.
Yes. Yeah, I don't really know how to respond, to be honest, because I feel like that's a very, a very personal reaction. I can't.
Really, and I think that could be. That's probably the case because, like, watching this movie, it was very obvious to me that, you know, it's made with incredible skill. Mm-hmm. So I guess it just comes down to how much the vision and the intent behind it connected with me personally, I suppose.
One of my problems with it, just on an idea level, is that none of the ideas layered with the others. Like, and again, this may just be a problem with adapting a novel like this. I couldn't see the through line of one conversation affecting the next or affecting this character. Everything happened in a vacuum. I don't know.
I guess I feel as though all the dialogue is working toward the same point.
But so, I mean, if that's the case, like, is it necessary? You could have made a 10-minute movie that said the same thing and did the same thing.
Well, no, but I think the characters are saying similar things in a different fashion. And even if it is repetitive, not only is that part of the idea, but I found it stimulating to watch. I don't know. I liked it. It's the best way I could put it.
Yeah. I mean,
it was a romp.
It was a romp.
It's a screwball comedy.
Oh, man. I mean, I don't know. Nick, I would have loved to go into this movie with you just to see your reactions at certain parts. For instance, when he's talking to the record producer and he hugs him, did you laugh out loud?
I didn't LOL, but I did laugh, certainly.
Okay. Because there was like riotous, uproarious laughter
right,
in
because
my theater. And I couldn't tell. Like, that's the problem. I couldn't tell if that's what you wanted. Like, This is
this is not a question in my mind. That's how you're supposed to react.
To that moment.
But I mean, that's the thing. Like, it happens there, and I'm like, it can't be that they sucked so much that they accidentally made this funny. It has to be funny on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, that's the most emotional, though, that his character is throughout the film.
Right. It is.
Which is, in a way, funny.
But that's my problem. Like, if this is a movie where reading the audience reaction against the film was really difficult for me. I couldn't tell if they were responding appropriately. If that makes sense. Like, you go to a movie like The Room or Birdemic, and you can tell that you're laughing at the movie and not with it. And this movie honestly felt a little bit like that. I didn't know when we were working with the movie or when we were working against it.
Be careful when you invoke Tommy Wiseau, okay?
I'm not just saying...
Well, did the audience laugh at the prostate scene?
Not really.
Really?
There was, laugh, like, when the guy puts his glove on. But then the rest of it was just kind of like, all right.
You see, I think that scene is funny on two levels. One is the sound design, let's call it that. and another is the way they're talking, how the woman that he's with is saying how the economist freaked out because of the way the man breathes while he was speaking. To me, that just is – I find it funny just as a concept, but also because that's what really happens when somebody is giving a speech on Capitol Hill about this sort of thing. That felt very pointed and smart to me.
Yeah, no,
right, but that's
the
thing.
The book, when I was reading the book, I was like, yeah, that's a good point. Like, that happens.
So it's funny just because, yes, that's true to life. It's how the actress delivers it. And then there's also the weird sort of prurient notice about how she's holding the water bottle, too. Yeah. Again, it's so funny. I don't know how somebody couldn't get a kick out of that, but teach their own, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you, man.
To each their own water bottle. Whatever that means.
Yeah, so do we have any final thoughts on this film? I feel like we might have come to a point where our opinions are pretty well fleshed out.
Score is great. I've listened to it multiple times, and it's great to listen to while you drive around.
In your limo.
Yeah.
Watching people at ATMs.
Or watching that TV program where the guy gets stabbed in the eye.
That was... Yeah,
disturbing.
It was
very fake looking. I don't know.
Yeah, that was. I think it was part of the, you know.
Yeah, part of the idea.
Yeah, and that's another. Like, I was like, that's another point where I was like, I know Cronenberg has it within himself to do an eye stabbing really well, so I know that must be meant to look fake.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't work in the moment for me. Like, these are like I said, some of these ideas are interesting and they're good, and I know what they're trying to accomplish, but the cohesive whole, not so much.
All right.
So, yes, those are our thoughts on Cosmopolis. It's out in limited release now. Probably going to be expanding as time goes on. So, you know, according to everyone but me, you should check it out if you're the right type of person. I would say just read the book. It's not that long, and it's a lot better than the movie, which is something I usually don't make a point of saying, but this is like the most step-for-step obvious adaptation of a book ever.
Yeah, if you read the book, it's hard not to think about it while watching the movie, because so much of it is copy and paste, and deliberately, but that doesn't mean it's not copy and paste.
Right. So, yeah, if you've read the book, you probably don't want to see the movie. That's my opinion. And I'm the host, so that means nothing. But yes, let's move on now into looking at the week ahead, new DVD and theatrical releases, and we can give our slight take on that, and then sign off for you fair people. Looking at DVDsReleaseDates.com, a number of winners coming out this week. We have Think Like a Man, Battleship, The Lucky One, Headhunters, and The Pirates, Band of Misfits, along with The Moth Diaries. Everything is coming out this weekend. Apartment 143 and a number of television shows. So,
Darling
Companion. What was that?
Darling Companion. Lawrence Kasdan's follow-up to Dreamcatcher.
Wow.
Hooray.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any movies that they'd specifically say they think people should check out on DVD this week?
I haven't seen Battleship yet, but I assume it's excellent.
It's dumb fun. I don't know. I was vaguely positive on that film, which is a terrible thing to say after I just said that I didn't like Cosmopolis, because now I feel like a Philistine. But
Squid in the Whale, Philistine.
I don't know. If you know what you're getting into with Battleship, it's not terrible. It's not great by any stretch of the imagination, but I don't know. It's on the level of the Avengers. Gonna get crucified for that one. Yeah, so I guess we can move on since no one's...
Headhunters is fun. I don't know if anyone's seen that.
I was gonna say, I'm not getting a lot of strong reactions to the DVD lineup. I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Quadrophenia is coming out. I've never seen that.
Yeah, I've never seen that either.
Yeah, I'm not really a Who guy, so...
Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, maybe theatrical
Teenage
releases.
Teenage Wasteland!
There you go.
Now everyone has to sing a lyric from a Who song.
Nah.
God damn it, Nick, you're such a buzzkill.
Sorry.
Yeah, coming out to theaters, we have a few better options for you fine people. We have Lawless, the new film by John Hillcoat with Tom Hardy and Shia LaBeouf and Guy Pearce. We have The Possession, which is a horror film about a box. We have For a Good Time Call. And yeah, it's basically about it for new releases.
Oogie Loves in the Big Balloon Adventure.
Good Lord. Okay, so we talked about Paranorman last week, and obviously when you go to see a kids film like that, you're going to see kids trailers. Most of them were not bad. Like, you know, some stuff out that looks like it could be pretty decent. I hate the trailer for Despicable Me 2 with those friggin' minions just saying potato to the tune of Bob Moran. But the trailer for Oogie Loves came on, and that was terrifying. It was more terrifying than anything I saw in Paranorman. Like, just fucking frightening.
Wait, what is it? I don't know what this is.
It's like full-size puppet people. Right? Like, that's a good way to put it, right? Like, it's like full-size Muppets. It's like someone in a Muppet costume with like one of those mouths that you can move on the inside with a string so it looks like you're talking.
Is this foreign or
I don't know what it is. The greatest thing is I have to watch the trailer again. No, I don't have to, but really don't want to. But I swear to God,
it's Chaz Palminteri.
Yeah, like it has. Is Cloris Leachman in there too?
Oh, the kids! Yeah. The kids love Cloris
Chaz
Palminteri
and Tony Braxton too.
Yeah. Fuck, like, ridiculous. I don't know what this film is doing. But,
it sounds like a lost, creepy kids movie from, like, 1984.
Right? The best part is, I'm pretty sure, don't quote me on this because I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that it says at some point, like, you know, it has to tell you who it's coming from so you know, like, that it's going to be good. Like, parents want to know, like, oh, it's from the people who did that show. It's going to be great for my kids. I think it says from, like, the marketing genius... Like, yeah. they're pointing out the people who did the marketing on other things. Like, they're literally saying, we made this to sell it to you.
It doesn't really have a studio. It's distributed by Ken Wieselman Presents.
So
I don't know what that is.
Ken Wieselman. Just a dude.
And the poster says you can see it on August 29.
Yeah, which is not a real month. So I don't even know if this is coming out. They could be screwing with us. No, like, I encourage everyone to see this trailer at least once. It's awful. It's the type of awful that you and your friends can get a kick out of. Mm. Like, it's hard for me to remember being a child. You know, it's a long time ago. And being in that, especially that zone where you're that age and you want to see things like that. I don't believe that even my young self would have wanted to see that. I can't imagine the type of child who sees that and is like, yes, I must be a part of that. Like, I grew up in the cynical 90s where we talked about killing Barney in song form in like kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Spending way too much time talking about Oogie Loves.
I'm watching the trailer on mute right now.
You're watching the trailer on mute.
Yeah, this is
it's terrifying.
They're putting on a rock performance.
Yep.
So
and Chaz Palminteri is he's like a malt shop guy.
Yeah, his character's named Marvin Milkshake.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. Anyway, I'm going to say that if Sleepwalk With Me is opening in your area, which it is for me, I mean, you should check that out because I've heard good things. But my biggest thing that I'm looking forward to that I can't wait to see is Lawless. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have opinions? Is anyone aching to see for a good time call?
I've I've seen it.
I know you have, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we'll be in sync with one another, because you told me Cosmopolis was great.
Mm-hmm. And
now I'm
it
worried,
is,
man.
So
now I'm worried. Can't awkward. Trust you again. yeah, does anyone else have a thing they want to push? The Possession and For a Good Time Call. Let's just say, would anyone say that they're looking forward to either of those films?
Ari Grainer, the actress in For a Good Time Call, I kind of like her.
Yeah.
That movie has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's automatically going to be really good.
Yeah, I don't know if there's much else to say about The Possession. It's produced by Sam Raimi, but that doesn't mean much because he produces a lot of bad movies. So, it is confounding that The Apparition came out this week, and now there's The Possession the next week.
Oh, The Apparition came out?
Yeah.
Man.
0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah,
it's supposed
to be
for that
awful
movie that I'm just like, oh, that's happening. Ouch. Sorry, Apparition. So yeah, moving on, we can get into our random reviews, or random recommendations, I should say. So, Ethan, what did you see this week that you think people should take some time and check out?
I will recommend Luchino Visconti's The Damned, which is his film about Nazism in the mid-1930s. And what's interesting about it is how Visconti came from aristocracy, and he was also a homosexual man, and that very much comes out in this film, because it really shows this kind of gay man rising to power in this time, and sort of it ties the idea of sexuality and Nazism into a really interesting theme. So I definitely recommend that, and it's, as with Visconti, completely visually spectacular and also very strange, many very strange camera choices. Definitely recommend this film.
All right. And Nick, what about yourself?
Saw some good stuff this week. Several of them were directed by Tony Scott, but I figure it's a little silly to mention that now. So I'll throw out Hour of the Wolf, which is an Ingmar Bergman movie from 1968 that stars Liv Ullmann and Max von Sydow. Has anybody here seen it?
I've seen it.
Yes. Do you like it?
I do. Quite a bit.
I think it's a great film. It's only... thing is, it's an extremely dense movie, so to discuss it after only seeing it once and perhaps being a little tired would be, well, to discuss it in a deep fashion would maybe be futile, but I did love it. Extremely, like Persona, it is unsettling on the grounds of just more what he's saying than what he's showing, which is not what you'd always expect, but the black and white cinematography and the setting and the performances are all very chilling. It's on Netflix Watch Instantly too, so please give that a look. You get a little Erland Josephson as well. Great actor.
And Danny, what about yourself?
I'm going to cheat a little bit and recommend a double feature.
Oh, snap.
Because one's a remake of the other. The first one is Claude Chabrol's The Unfaithful Wife, and then Adrian Lyne's Unfaithful from 2002. Chabrol's movie is automatically better because it has subtitles and it's older.
and it's in black and white, right?
Yeah. Actually, I don't think it is. but it has subtitles. To me, they're really fun to watch back to back because the obvious difference between the two is a really big one, which is that... the basic story is that a husband just finds out that his wife is cheating on him. And in Chabrol's movie, the man she's cheating with isn't seen that often. And in Unfaithful, he's basically a main character, because to sell a movie in 2002, you have to show Diane Lane, you know, having sex with a foreign artist. And that's how things work. But it's interesting to me that that's such a big change from the two movies, and yet Unfaithful still has like minute details that it takes from Chabrol's movie. So it's just interesting to me that why did they even bother remaking that movie? Why not just make another movie about infidelity? It's not like it's a groundbreaking subject matter. But both movies are really fun and interesting to watch back to back from a remake standpoint.
All right. And I saw Magnolia. I think
I just bought that on Blu-ray over the weekend.
Yeah, I went to a used DVD and CD place in my neighborhood, and I bought Magnolia, and I watched it, and it was awesome again, which is great. I'm just trying to get myself in the mood for The Master, So yeah, Can I even? Is it possible to even give a synopsis of Magnolia?
I think we should all sing "Wise Up."
Okay. See, I wanted us all to sing lyrics, and no one wanted to do it. No one wanted to do The Who. But now you're just all about Amy, man.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you start, Nick.
No.
Right. It's not. It's not what you thought when you first began.
Yeah. Can't wait to do the Les Miserables podcast. I'm going to demand songs. Watch for it. But yeah, you should check it out, everyone at home. It's a really good film. Follows a bunch of people on a single day, their lives slowly unraveling. There's a lot more to it than that. That's a really crappy synopsis. Yeah,
I'd be surprised if anybody listening has not seen Magnolia by this point.
I should hope not. Which is to say, I should hope that they have not seen it. Which is to say that I hope that they have seen it. Which is a really complicated way of drawing this conversation to a close. We'll give you all a rundown of where you can find us on the internet. Ethan, why don't you start us off?
First off, go to Facebook. You all have Facebook, right?
Yes.
Go to Fade to Black on CUTV and like that page because we're trying to get more likes. And after you've done that, go to Twitter, because I assume you're all on Twitter, and go to twitter.com/EthanVest, because really that's where the action happens.
Yeah. You're the Fade to Black cover photos. You're reading The Help.
Yep, so you know it's good.
And Nick, what about yourself?
Thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman. I'm often retweeting Ethan, but if you follow him, the retweets won't mean as much, I guess.
It's weird you just retweet everything I say that's racist.
Yeah.
Good old
because passion. I can't say it, but...
But I can agree with it implicitly by retweeting it.
Yeah, I'm not even saying I agree with it. I'm just, this is what somebody said.
And Danny, what about yourself?
Thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
All right, and you can find me at my private blog, dearfilm.net. You can also find me on The Film Stage, where my review of Premium Rush is currently sitting around waiting for your eyeballs. And you can find me on twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So thank you again for joining us, and make sure to tune in next week when we'll be discussing Lawless.